You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, the Detect Initiative in Early Alzheimer's Disease, Optimizing Collaboration and Multidisciplinary Care to Facilitate Timely Diagnosis. I'm joined by Liana Apostolova, Indiana University Distinguished Professor and Barbara and Pierre Backard Professor in Alzheimer's Disease Research at Indiana University, and Dr. Diana Kerwin, Founder and President of Kerwin Medical Center and Chief of Geriatric Medicine at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. They have a very interesting case to discuss, and I'm excited to get started. Welcome.
Thank you, Deb.
Thank you, Deb. Good to see you.
So let's start with the case. Tony is an 86-year-old white male who presents to his primary care doctor. He says he's been more distractible lately, slowed down considerably in the past 2 years, and recently got lost twice when driving. His wife says he no longer follows the stock market and is less active in financial responsibilities. He has also stopped playing bridge. She also thinks he's depressed. He has a history of prostate cancer, hypercholesterolemia, basal cell carcinoma, and AV block. He is currently taking simvastatin, zaleplon, and selexicab FH. His mother died at 53 from alcohol abuse. His father was diagnosed with dementia in his early 80s and died at 89. Tony and his wife have 3 healthy children. He scored a 17 out of 30 on the MoCA, missing points on the past presidents. He got 2 out of 5 and refused to try further. He missed important details from recent major events, such as the war in Ukraine. His spoken language is intact, and he scored 11 out of 15 on the Boston naming test. On the bedside test of abstract thinking, he correctly identified 1 of the 2 similarities but refused to do the proverb. Parietal function exam found left-right discrimination okay, finger identification okay, but calculation impaired. Physical exam revealed decreased hearing, absent ankle reflexes, bradykinesia, bradyphrenia, and decreased stride length. So I'll just start this out and let you all start with a discussion on this case.
Dr. Apostolova, do you want to go first?
Oh, sure. Yeah, my pleasure. So this is a case that I saw in my clinic. So it was a very accomplished gentleman that had some functional decline due to the fact that he was no longer as interested in finances and not able to really focus as well and make complicated financial decisions about his finances and his business. And the fact that he also has stopped playing a game such as bridge also alludes to functional changes. And so he, by this criterion, having some change from premorbid functioning, he would actually meet criteria for mild dementia. Given that he's still driving, I would place him definitely in the mild dementia range. However, of course, I'd be a little concerned about his driving since he got lost twice recently and would be inclined to ask more questions about safety if anyone was with him as a passenger. How about you?
Yeah, I think you bring up some really good points. You know, from a geriatric standpoint, we always go from what's their baseline function and are they still at their baseline function? Because as you said, for this gentleman, very high level of his adult life functioning, executive, accomplished. And so that kind of apathy that he's showing where he's not following the stock markets any longer, and he might say he's not interested, but is it that he's having more difficulty to follow the details of the stock market and some of the higher level, you know, financial things that he probably did in the past, and kind of that sign of that executive dysfunction starting to be impaired. And so, again, I think the importance of that history of what was their function all along, what are they now not doing that they used to do very easily. And then I agree with you. I think with there appears to be some, you know, parietal signs with the numbers or the numerics, and then that getting lost while driving, you wonder if he's starting to have maybe some visual, spatial issues, or just not recognizing familiar places. So I think exactly, I'd be concerned with kind of that executive dysfunction starting, and the fact that he got lost twice. It's sort of like that's our red flag, because then we don't know when that's going to happen again, when it might be more severe, or if there might be an accident associated with that. So I agree. And I think, you know, sometimes that apathy gets put as a mild depression, and it's really just that, they're pulling away because those activities are becoming more difficult, not necessarily that they're sad or depressed.
Yeah. And what do you think, Dr. Kerwin, in terms of his physical examination, there is some bradykinesia, bradyphrenia, decreased stride length. Yet we need to remember he's 86 years old. Is that common in the geriatric population you see? Would you be worried and ask for a consult with a neurologist, or?
Yeah. So when I start to see the type of physical findings, because again, usually with Alzheimer's disease, there are not motor findings in particular with gait and things. But again, with his age, 86 year old, he does have some vascular risk factors. So although we've already had a peek at his imaging, I would have anticipated before I ordered the MRI that he's going to have some small vessel ischemic changes. And some of that small vessel ischemia, depending on where it's located, might cause some motor slowing, some decreased stride length, or some issues with the kind of the slowness of his gait or changes. The decreased reflexes are something, especially when it's kind of all around or just a decrease in the ankles or what have you, that's kind of a common geriatric finding with aging and doesn't really worry me unless I see hyperreflexia on one side and then normal or absent reflexes on the other, if it's locating to one side or the other. But otherwise, that is a normal aging sign. But again, I would anticipate we're going to see probably some small vessel ischemia on his MRI to show that there's always usually some comorbid vascular changes in people with vascular risk factors and Alzheimer's. It's very rare that you see just Alzheimer's pathology and no vascular changes. And since you're seeing the signs on the physical exam already, again, I would just kind of be anticipating I'm going to see that.
Okay, great. So should we look at the MRI? I have it here and I can summarize the findings. There is generalized atrophy, possibly a little bit more than what we expect for an 86-year-old. The hippocampi are moderately atrophic. The main atrophy seems to be localizing more specifically to the parietal lobes. It's bilateral. And in terms of white matter changes, it is not profound, definitely not to the extent of severe. I would say mild to moderate based on the fact that I see these white matter changes sort of surround the ventricles, but in a thin layer. It's not really a major pathology at this point, but certainly could be a contributing pathology to some of the findings.
Yeah, I agree. I think just some general atrophy or mild, but definitely more pronounced in the parietal lobes, it appears. And then again, that periventricular atrophy, or excuse me, periventricular white matter changes. The ventricles, lateral ventricles look a little bit generous, but I think, did you think that was more associated with the atrophy?
Yeah.
It doesn't look like any of the other ventricles are enlarged. Yeah.
Right. Given the amount of atrophy, the amount of ventricular expansion probably is passive. I also noticed there is a cavum septum pellucidi, which is inborn sort of abnormality that we see in a subset of the population, doesn't have much impact or clinical significance, but it's there. So with that type of findings on the scan, how in primary practice, how would you further work up this gentleman and treat him?
So with his age, you know, being 86, again, is still the most likely cause of a decline in cognitive function, again, impairing his general daily function, is still Alzheimer's disease. It's not likely to be like a frontal temporal dementia. The MRI rules out any other major CNS process that might point me in a different direction, but it would be a good idea to have biomarkers on this gentleman. I'd like to see either I don't know that I would do a spinal tap on him, but if I did have the ability to get even a glucose PET just so I can see what the physiologic functioning is of the neurons in certain areas, or if it's possible to get an amyloid PET or CSF for amyloid biomarkers or blood-based biomarkers. That would all be very helpful. And this gentleman, I probably would send him for full neuropsych evaluation just to get a little bit more detail on some of the concerns about driving. And it would give me a bit more of what is where exactly he is, and we could follow that over time. But I do think if there was a way to get any biomarkers, it would be helpful.
And we did that, actually. We had the opportunity to get an amyloid PET scan on him, which was positive, meaning that there is binding to amyloid plaques in the brain. So with that information, what would the therapeutic approaches be for you in general practice? Would a referral be made, or how would you approach it?
Yeah, so I think for general practice, and I'll go back a little bit in time and say before I would have gone for the amyloid biomarker, I would, again, make sure in the cognitive evaluation, you've ruled out hypothyroidism, you've ruled out a pronounced B12 deficiency, and all that's been done. There's no liver dysfunction, kidney dysfunction, or something in his medication list that would tell you that there's something else that could be causing cognitive decline. And then I'd also get a sleep history. But now that we know he's having cognitive decline, this looks progressive. It looks like it's kind of following in an Alzheimer's pattern, again, with more posterior cortical dominant or parietal dominant, but still the amyloid presence does tell me that that's likely it's an Alzheimer's pathology that's causing the cognitive decline. So for this, because he is symptomatic, he's showing signs of daily impairments in memory, we would start with some of the symptomatic therapies that are still considered the gold standard, which would be a cholinesterase inhibitor. And then in my case, I would probably also add memantine at the same time. Sometimes you wait until they go, but in my practice, we just tend to add them both together. And then the question now, because we do have some of the amyloid monoclonal antibodies that are becoming available, you know, the question is if you would do anything further, but the discussion becomes a little bit more complicated because of the payer system. And so again, the access to that might be limited, but I definitely would talk to him about symptomatic therapies, cholinesterase inhibitor, memantine. We would talk about safety. So we would talk about likely cessation of driving, help with his finances, anything that might come about due to his cognitive impairment that could cause a risk to him or his wife. So again, financial restraint or financial parameters so that he doesn't end up having financial issues, driving safety, safety in the home, is someone helping him to oversee his medications, and then general lifestyle. We do know that even with cognitive impairment, an exercise regimen like walking, if it's safe for him to walk, to do a walking regimen, and then looking at his diet. I don't know, what else would you do at this point, Dr. Apostolova?
So yeah, no, I can definitely take the questions about monoclonal antibodies and tell you what my practice will be once we have insurance coverage. Something else I might suggest for this gentleman is hearing aids as well, because when people don't hear well, which is the case here, they kind of disengage, and that can contribute further to social isolation. And it's really been shown that decreased hearing impacts function in people with dementia. So that's the only other thing that I would have mentioned.
That's a great point. Something that's often overlooked, and now over-the-counter hearing aids are available. So that actually has become much more accessible in the last year.
So in terms of the new medications, I would consider this gentleman with mild dementia to be a good candidate. However, before considering and counseling him about the medications and the expected benefits and risks, we need to ascertain his APOE4 genotype. The monoclonal antibodies show that individuals who carry one or two copies of the sporadic Alzheimer's disease risk factor APOE4 have greater prevalence of side effects. Not that everybody gets them, but it's just a greater proportion of the population who were in the trial and had copies of APOE4 had either cerebral edema or cerebral hemorrhage. It is not that people with one or two copies would be contraindicated to receive the drug. It's just that they need to be counseled about their specific risk and understand what that is. So that would be my next step followed by a very detailed discussion of what the medication is expected to do, the frequency of the infusions, the fact that these are infusions, and the fact that serial MRI monitoring will be needed for patient safety, and of course, the much, much important risk side effect sort of discussion to be had. And ultimately, the decision comes to the patient and their family whether this is a good, appropriate medication for them and they would like to try it.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point about the risk discussion, and you know, definitely every medication has its side effects. I think for this gentleman, I think you know, not being on anticoagulants is a good is another discussion. Several patients, you know, as they get up over their 80s and have atrial fibrillation and might be on anticoagulants, is where that discussion becomes a bit more rigorous regarding, you know, what potentially those risks might be. And if they were APOE4 homozygote as well, then you add sort of that increased risk factor. But I think for every medication, there's always that informed consent discussion about risks, benefits, and then anticipating what, you know, what we would hope to see, you know, with the treatment.
So actually, I have a question, thinking about it from your typical internist or primary care doctor. Is this something at that level that they should be learning and getting ready to handle as these new drugs come up and their patients who know them best are going to be asking about it? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think it's something that as a field, we really need to be thinking about, because, you know, these medications in development oftentimes are being done at specialty neurology and academic centers, or at least infusion centers that have the understanding and capability to do just straight IV infusions. But then on top of it, you add to having some type of level of comfort, of expertise, of knowing how to evaluate cognitive decline, how to diagnose Alzheimer's disease, what biomarkers would be needed to determine if the anti-amyloid monoclonals are appropriate for a patient. And then again, being able to administer and understand what the safety oversight is. You'd need to know that you have a good MRI imaging center with a radiologist who's going to be able to pick up on any of the amyloid-related imaging abnormalities that can occur with these medications. So I do think, I mean, there's nothing that can't be overcome. I think that if primary care delivers other very high level and complicated therapies in their office, but it's just a level of comfort. And I think starting that education and awareness now will really help the patient populations, because if this unfortunately is not available, at least for the evaluation and referral to an infusion center or to a specialty center for treatment, a lot of patients will lose access to having these medications available. And I think now that we finally have something that appears to be able to modify the disease trajectory, we really don't want to have large swaths of the patients that are affected to not be able to access it because their physician's not been able to, I guess, understand some of the how the medications are administered, the safety oversight, and then feel comfortable with doing that in their own practices. I don't know how you view that, Dr. Pastelova, but I know I'm concerned about access for patients if we don't get more practitioners comfortable.
Certainly, there would be a learning curve, but outside neurologists, geropsychiatrists, geriatricians might very well be educated in how to safely administer aducanumab. Something that is important is that the infusion centers have the capability of responding to allergic reactions and whatnot, and also experienced staff that can do detailed neurological exams if any ARIA or these imaging abnormalities associated with these drugs are suspected. There has to be absolutely trained radiologists that will read the images, ways for these radiologists to alert the administering physician immediately as they identify ARIA. And also for severe cases, they would need to potentially be evaluated at emergency rooms or even admitted to the hospital. So all of that has to be outlined in a protocol for every practice and all that. It's really going to be a treatment team and collaboration between multiple specialties. So it's doable. We can do this for our patients, but we have to be proactive and very thoughtful about safety of administering monoclonal antibodies.
Absolutely agree. And I think, yeah, that team approach, definitely.
That's a great answer. And you brought up the multidisciplinary team, Dr. Apostolova. Briefly, we're almost out of time. Could the two of you describe the role of the primary care physician on that team and how it would actually work in real life?
Yeah, that's a great question for Dr. Kerwin.
Sure. So I think that identifying the patients that are having cognitive decline, starting that evaluation, you know, the initial history, medication history, starting, you know, ruling out any other factors, and then starting to either, like in this case, if you feel comfortable, get the MRI, if you can get biomarkers as you rule out any other underlying medical illnesses. And then if you, depending on what your practice setting is, getting some cognitive testing on the patient as well, which is part of the evaluation. But then are you partnered with either a specialty clinic that you can refer to, or there likely will be some primary care doctors that might be in rural areas or areas where there might be not be a specialty clinic around that might be the lead of the team, and then really having their imaging center, their infusion nurse, their team within the office really being the ones that are part of the safety core. I think in other places where you might have a specialty clinic nearby, either a behavioral neurologist, geriatric psychiatrist, or geriatrician that specializes in dementia and is also set up to administer these drugs, the primary care doctor then still becomes that co-management, where they'll still continue to co-manage the blood pressure, cholesterol, you know, the general primary care, and the specialist could then just take over the administration of the monoclonal antibody and some of the safety oversight, but it definitely would still be a team approach.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. We are just about out of time. I want to thank Dr. Apostolova and Dr. Kerwin for taking the time to speak today about the role of the primary care clinician in the early diagnosis of MCI and dementia. And thank you for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity.